My name is Terry Fredheim, and I teach Old Testament at Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And we have a series these 2 weeks on the God of the Old Testament. And today's topic is the anger of God. Probably not the best thing in the world to start the day with. It can get a little bracing as one reads some of these passages. But we hope that some of these materials will be of help to you. We can talk about them after some opening remarks. I think maybe one of the things we ought to do initially is get about 4 passages in our heads. And then you can be thinking about these a little bit as we talk further. Exodus 34. There are some front row seats right here. This audience is sort of like a typical Lutheran audience. They don't sit in the front rows. Exodus 34, beginning with verse 6. The Lord passed before him, I say Moses, and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger. Let's pause there for just a moment. Slow to anger. That's kind of an unusual phrase that occurs again and again in the Old Testament for God. One would have thought that God is never slow. I mean, God's always fast, right? But here, God is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. You notice that anger is not an attribute of God. Anger is never an attribute of God, like love or graciousness or faithfulness. Anger is always contingent. It's contingent upon the human behavior out there. And so it's a response of God to behaviors. It's not something, God is not always angry. Okay, it's not an attribute. Slow to anger, or patient, would be a way of talking about an attribute. Keeping, verse 7, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Now, I don't know about you, but I learned that last verse as a part of the conclusion to the Ten Commandments. I don't think they do anymore. I think they've cut it out from a lot of catechisms because it's a little too hard to handle, probably more for the teachers to handle than for the kids to handle. But the just a couple of words here, and we'll kind of weave back into this theme. This is not a statement about God sort of having some book up in heaven where he writes down, you know, each sin and then decides 3 or 4 generations down the pike, aha, I'm going to take it out now on this generation because of that sin back there. That's not the way this works. What it is an it's a statement about the intrinsic relationship of sin and its consequences. We all have everyday language. We say chickens come home to roost. We all know what that means. Well, that's what this verse says, really. That if you sow your wild oats, you're going to reap them. In effect, it's saying you sin and your sinful behavior in time will have ill effects upon one or another person or aspect of society. We all know what it means. In the 19th century, our treatment of the Native Americans, our treatment of the blacks, have in fact issued in consequences in this century which we have reaped. And so this is a statement about the moral order of things. Namely, sin will have consequences. We'll come back to a little bit more precise statements about the relationship between sin and consequences in a moment. We need to put alongside that Psalm 30, verse 5. This is one of my favorite sections. In a song of thanksgiving. Let's begin with verse 4 of Psalm 30. Sing praises to the Lord, all you his saints, and give thanks to his holy name. For his anger is but for a moment, and his favor is for a lifetime. Anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes with the morning. That's a fundamental statement about God's anger in relationship to God's graciousness or God's favor. The one is for a moment, the other is for a lifetime. Then let's turn to Zephaniah. I'm sure you haven't been into Zephaniah lately. But it's one of those little prophets at the end. Habakkuk, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Zephaniah was a prophet who preached just shortly before the fall of Jerusalem in the early part of the 6th century B.C. Somewhere around 610 or so, it was his time. And this, in chapter 1, is one of the most famous statements of the wrath of God. In fact, there's a medieval hymn entitled Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath, which was essentially a paraphrase of this section of Zephaniah and has become sort of the premier statement of the wrath of God. It is absolutely frightening, I think. And it's in the Hebrew. You can't catch you can catch some of the rhythm of the Hebrew, but the Hebrew, the original Hebrew, is staccato. It's just like, it just goes right down. And maybe I can do some of that when I read it in English. Chapter 1, beginning with verse 14. The great day of the Lord is near, near, hastening fast. The sound of the day of the Lord is bitter. The mighty man cries aloud there. Day of wrath is that day, a day of distress, a day of anguish, a day of ruin, of devastation, a day of darkness, of gloom, a day of clouds, of thick darkness, a day of trumpet blast and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the lofty battlements. Notice what it's against. And I will bring distress on people so that they shall walk like the blind because they've sinned against the Lord. And watch out, here we go. Their blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh like dung, and neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them on the day of the wrath of the Lord. For in the fire of his jealous wrath all the earth shall be consumed, for a full, yea, sudden end he will make of all the inhabitants of the earth. What do you do with that? Well, let's turn to Isaiah, which will have something to do with that. Isaiah 54. The Zephaniah passage is the passage comes before the fall of Jerusalem, before the judgment of the Babylonians against the Israelites. Chapter 54 of Isaiah comes after the fall, after the judgment, after the day of wrath. And begin with verse 6. For the Lord has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, like a wife of youth when she is cast off, says your God. For a brief moment I forsook you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In overflowing wrath for a moment I hid my face from you, but with everlasting love I will have compassion on you, says the Lord your Redeemer. His anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. Now, some reflections on these texts, and then we'll pick up a couple of other texts as we go along here, as time permits. Remember again, as we've stressed all these times together, that anger is a metaphor. Anger is human language, language that we use to talk about the human, used to talk about God. And any language that we use any human language that we use to talk about God is inadequate. There are continuities between that human language and the reality which is God, but there are discontinuities. And when it comes like to a word like anger, we need to pay as much attention to that as we do with a word like father or a word like love. Anger. We know from the life of Jesus that anger can be expressed in appropriate ways. As the one as the passage in the New Testament says, it's possible to be angry and not sin. And in Jesus' own life, we know a number of instances where Jesus expressed anger. We all know the cleansing of the temple, for example. We all know those statements against the Pharisees, "You brood of vipers." You know, I mean, that language gets to be very, it's anger language, strong language. So we know that Jesus used language in appropriate ways, and we can then extrapolate from that and talk about anger that would be expressed by God in comparable ways. But there are also discontinuities in our understanding of anger. We as human beings express anger in ways that are not very appropriate at times and not very helpful. We're not angry for a moment. We're angry for a lifetime oftentimes. Our anger often turns into embitterment, and our anger is expressed in ways that are reveal of anything but love that lies at the base of the expression of anger. So you need to constantly work at that, the is and the is not of the metaphor, the yes and the no of the metaphor. What really applies to God about anger and what doesn't apply to God about anger. Another thing I need to say generally is that with regard to anger and our reflection on the anger of God, we tend to fall off on one side of the horse or the other rather than stay right on top of the horse. On the one hand, we are sometimes all too eager to call something the judgment of God. We are all too eager to point to something and say, "Hey, there's the judgment of God. There's the anger of God being manifest over there." We like to name something in those terms. And we all know that there are certain people who are too eager to preach judgment and preach the anger of God. I don't mean to pick on televangelists, but there's at least one group of people generally that seems that makes the anger of God just a little bit, my mind at least, a little bit too central in the word that they preach. One of the things that I always look for in assessing people's talk or preachers' talk about the anger or judgment of God, I always look for one thing, and then I can move out from there. I look to see against whom is the anger of God being visited. And if in fact, as is commonly the case, that the anger of God is being expressed against the outsiders. In other words, it's not being expressed against those who are listening to the preacher. It's being expressed against those others, those out there, you know, who are giving us all these problems or who are doing this or doing that. The key to the anger of God, which you find in the prophets, is that the prophets almost always are expressing the anger of God against the insiders. They're expressing the anger of God against the people of God, the chosen people. And when I hear the anger of God then being focused on the audience, those who are inside, those who are supporting the preacher, then I will begin to think about that kind of preaching being appropriate with respect to the talk of divine anger. But in any case, a second piece with regard to that is that where the anger finally leads is the anger but for a moment and the favor for a lifetime. Does it finally lead to a proclamation of the gospel, or does it hang in midair as anger? That's one side. I think we fall off the horse. The other side, and I worry about this among mainstream Protestants, I guess, more, don't have to worry about the fundamentalists on this side or the TV evangelists on this side of the forest. And that is the message of the anger of God gets ignored. And to use Elmer's language from Sunday night, God is too nice. God is buddy-buddy. It's God and me, arm in arm, down the road. You know, my God and I walk through the fields together. We walk and talk as good friends used to do. I grew up on that. You know, everything's hunky-dory, folks, just me and God. And that's falling off the horse on the other side. Because if your God is not critical of who you are and what you do, if your God is not speaking a word of judgment to you about your behaviors, then you better take another look. So we've got to somehow stay on the horse between those two extremes. Now, when you take a look at particularly that Zephaniah passage, there are Christians who say, well, you know, Jesus came to save us from that kind of God, and you wouldn't find the New Testament talking like that. Well, I'm afraid we do. In fact, there are sharper, more intense statements with regard to the wrath of God in the New Testament than the Old Testament ever imagined. I mean, in the Book of Revelation, they're wading horse high in blood. And Jesus' own statements in the Gospels, you know, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth in the fires of hell forever. Now, the Old Testament never gets to that point. The Old Testament, because for most of the Old Testament time, they don't have a belief in the afterlife. They believe everything is taken care of in this life. And then as you move toward the late Old Testament material and between the Testaments and the New Testament, then you get the notion of eternal life. Well, the statements of the New Testament is that the anger of God, the judgment of God, finally, final judgment, the last judgment, that kind of talk, will issue in eternal hell. The Old Testament doesn't talk like that. And that's because the Old Testament, the Old Testament language seems especially strong because it's so this worldly. And it's all in terms of this life and the effects that judgment can have in this world. Whereas the New Testament tends to push it off into another world, not always. Which brings then to sort of three understandings of judgment that I think we commonly have, which are one-sided at best and just mistaken and at worst. Depends upon how they're phrased. But one understanding of judgment is a typical Lutheran understanding of judgment, and it's what I would call the inward understanding of judgment. And that is that the judgment of God is expressed primarily in the stricken conscience. You hear the law preached on a Sunday morning, and that, you know, your conscience is stricken, and you move to repentance and hear the word of the gospel. That move is a relatively common way of talking about judgment, the inner move. But you know, if you talk about judgment, the judgment of God, solely in inward terms, then healing can only be inward too. And we have a tendency to do that, to keep everything on the inside on these matters. And that's important, an important dimension of what law and judgment is about. It cannot be the only word about the matter. A second, which I've already alluded to, a second understanding of judgment is what we have this 50-cent word that we throw around in theological circles called eschatological, namely the reference to the next world, the future. And we tend to push judgment in anything other than the inward matter. We tend to push judgment off into the next world. Someday they'll all go to hell, right? Just, I mean, they may be getting along just fine now, and just wait. And so Christians sometimes, delight all too much in that kind of talk. And that way we can afford not to have to deal with the matter now. Someday God will just take care of it all. And so by pushing all such judgments then outside of the inward person to the next world, we can avoid having to deal with those kinds of things in this world. Because that becomes a problem if you start dealing with matters of judgment in this life. You either end up saying, so-and-so down the street has got cancer, that's the judgment of God. You make that move, which is not very helpful. Because you can't make that kind of move, then you kind of back off and push everything off into the future. A third way in which we make use of the judgment of God that's not very helpful is in forensic, but I can't think of a better single word. We think of divine judgment in forensic terms. I grew up on a lot of forensic judgment talk. By that I mean that God is about the business of making explicit decisions with regard to judgment. And it's kind of a wait until your father gets home kind of understanding of judgment. You know, if you do this or if you do that, then there's a lightning bolt that's headed your way. Huh? And it's a kind of understanding of judgment that keeps you looking over your left shoulder, you know, when you're engaged in certain types of behavior. That understanding of judgment is not very helpful because the vast majority of, not that there aren't a couple of passages here and there that do push in that direction, but the vast majority of judgment, the language in the Old Testament has to do with what I've already alluded to, namely that the sin or the consequences of sin and the sin are intrinsically related, so that sin issues in certain consequences. It's a part of the moral order of things that sin will have certain effects. You get drunk, you get in your car, and you drive 90 miles an hour, there's probably a bridge abutment waiting for you down the road someplace. There's a consequence for the behavior which you engage in. So that there you've got God involved, not sort of zapping you with lightning bolts from the outside, but God seeing to a moral order. God seeing to a moral order that, in fact, sin will have consequences. And so one can talk about the judgment of God, or one can use language of judgment to simply say, judgment is that sin has consequences. Now, a few other things. There is in the Old Testament, rarely, a juristic understanding of judgment. Judgment is usually not juristically conceived. That is to say, you don't have a situation in the prophets where you go sort of take the people into a courtroom and you say, aha, you've committed this sin, and there is specified in the law that there is this punishment for that sin, and hence you're going to have that punishment. That's not the way in which the prophets talk about judgment as related to the penalty for a particular sin. It's kind of interesting, if you go back into the laws, Old Testament laws, it's not very common, actually, that you find a specific penalty for sins. All the Ten Commandments, you know, there's no penalty associated with the disobedience of any of the Ten Commandments. It's an interesting dimension of much of Old Testament law that you don't find the penalty specified. But rather, one needs to think about not a courtroom situation with respect to judgment, although it's hard for us to get that out of our mind with a word like judgment. But one needs to think about, rather, a personal relationship. And what does it mean for God to enter into a relationship with people and to have a loving, close, real relationship of integrity with people, and to talk about judgment then within the context of a personal relationship. I would invite you to think about judgment in relational terms rather than in more external, juristic, courtroom kind of terms. And I want to come back and do an illustration on that in just a moment. But you know, again and again, we see how patient God is with the people. You know, God doesn't bring the judgment that the people deserve again and again. I mean, if God had visited the people with the judgment they deserved, they wouldn't have lasted a generation. You don't have God then measuring judgment in terms of some legal statute. I mean, that's not how that works. God's judgment is never simply justice. God's response goes beyond justice again and again and again. It's never unjust, it's never capricious, it's always fair, but it's not simple, juristic in its understanding. Another thing is God never wants judgment. God never wants destruction. Remember that passage that we listed on Monday? God always desires, this is Ezekiel 18, God always desires life and not death. That's what God wants. So judgment is not a move which God desires. That's a last resort kind of move on God's part. In fact, so pervasive is God's will to save rather than to judge that God will even take back a prophetic word. We saw that on Monday. You go forth, Jeremiah 26, you go forth, you preach to this people, and maybe they'll repent, and I'll take back the announcement of judgment that I've pronounced. Huh? I'll take it back. Because I want life and not death. So God's even willing to take back announcements if, in fact, the people turn from their ways and there's another way possible into the future. One passage that I'd like to have you look at is go back to Genesis chapter 6, verse 6. The end of verse 5 of Genesis 6. This is just before the flood story. By the way, you know, sometimes people look at the flood story and they use the flood story to illustrate the judgment of God. I said, no. Why? Why do you never use the flood story as an illustration of the judgment of God? Who knows?
Redemption.
He promised to never do it again.
Exactly. He promised to never do it again. And so that flood can never be used as an illustration of divine judgment. God promised never to do that sort of thing again. What does it mean for God never to say something like that? That's really, I'll never do that again. Doesn't sound like something that God can say, does it? But it does. Let's look at the beginning of the flood story here, though. The Lord saw that the wickedness of human beings was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made human beings on the earth. And then notice the language. And it grieved him to his heart. Let me just rephrase that in modern terminology. The judgment of God is always accompanied by the grief of God. The judgment of God is always accompanied by the grief of God. Or even another way of saying that is that the Godward side of wrath is grief. And so God, the God who enters into judgment, moves into judgment with tears flowing down his face. Never forget that. Now let me try to talk about judgment within the context of a personal relationship. And this can get the illustration I may use can be a little touchy, but let's try it. Let me define judgment in relational terms. Judgment is the breakdown of a personal relationship with its associated effects. Judgment is the breakdown of a personal relationship with its associated effects. That's to say, whenever you've got a relationship that's begun to break down on you in one way or another, you have mixed in there anger and pain and sorrow and, you know, all, you know, we all know what those emotions are that are associated with a breakdown in a relationship. The one commentator has this interesting way of putting it. When judgment comes, the people should know that they have been visited not with the strict and icy indifference of a judge, but with the pain and the anger. Let me use the analogy of a marriage breaking up. I think it can be used in this connection, if, again, carefully, as the closeness of the relationship ebbs, as the partners remove themselves more and more from intimacy with one another, they experience more and more the effects of brokenness in their lives. Now, to use that as an analogy. An analogy, okay, which means that there isn't a one-to-one correspondence, okay? To use that, this is an analogy. From the prophet's point of view, the effect of brokenness, the effects of brokenness in the relationship between God and people equals judgment. It is, I think it's striking, you take that Isaiah 54 passage that we looked at, that the language of God's judgment is more often than not the language of lightning bolt language, intervention language, rather, for a brief moment I forsook you, okay? For a brief moment, I withdrew from you. For a brief moment, I hid my face from you. But that's the language of withdrawal. Now, we all know what withdrawal means in terms of a breakdown of personal relationship. Withdrawal, forsaking, hiddenness, giving up, moving to the edge of things. And as people remove themselves from God, you know, God engages in major efforts to heal the breach, but God may finally be forced into a tearful withdrawal. Reluctantly allowing the forces that make for death and destruction to have their way. But while God may give them up, God will not finally give up on them. And God will be right back, trying until the last possible moment to heal the relationship. Well, maybe that's enough to get us started on some discussion here. I was going to talk just a little bit about more about this intrinsic relationship stuff, but we have maybe, you know, with visiting the fathers upon the children of the third and fourth generation, the positive side of that, the moral order works positively too, and you got to keep the negative and the positive together. So the positive way is best stated in, say, it's like the fourth commandment: honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Now kids only learn what? It makes me mad. Now they only learn honor your father and your mother, and then they put a period. And I don't know, some functionary somewhere apparently thought that all that rest of that was reward language or something. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. That's not reward language. That's intrinsic talk. That's to say, if you obey your father and your mother, if you honor your father and your mother, generally speaking, things are going to go better for you. Huh? Right? That's all it says. Not inevitably, not mechanically, not just simply externally, you know, not all the time, but if everyone honored their father and their mother, we'd have a better world. And again in the book of Deuteronomy, you know, that language is used, do this that you may live long. Do this, it's in your own best interest, folks, if you do this. Well, it's not kind of an inevitable relationship between the good deed and the good consequence, but generally speaking, that's how things are going to track. Well, that's the positive side of it, you know. That's the moral order on its positive side, and the moral order on its negative side is you commit certain sins, and you're going to reap certain consequences. Not inevitably. You know as well as I do, some people commit the worst sins and they get away scot-free. That's what we call generally a loose causal weave. Okay? You know, that's what it is. It's not a tight weave. You just don't have, you know, if you commit a good deed, inevitably a good consequence. If you commit a bad deed, inevitably a bad consequence. The causal weave is looser than that. And of course, if you want to make the why you got a loose causal weave, why did God set up a moral order such that it didn't just work mechanically, huh? And we'd all like the wicked to immediately get theirs, huh? And if we'd all like the righteous to immediately, you know, be rewarded for. But if you have a tight causal weave, you know, where you have a very rigid relationship between deed and consequence, a tight causal weave, then the room for creativity and ambiguity and complexity and novelty and progress and all those good things are not, I mean, the serendipity. Huh? You wouldn't have serendipity. And it's that possibility, it's that loose causal weave that makes for wonderful possibilities and newness in the world. Let's talk about it. Where would you like to move that? Everything clear, I think.
Would it be appropriate, Dr. Fredheim, to say then that the 10 words are parameters, the universal laws of God, that going beyond them one is indeed broken, but that no one breaks those laws?
You're talking about 10 commandments now. Scholars fuss a lot about what the 10 commandments are and how they function, and whether they're a summary of the rest of the laws somehow, whether they, you know, I think that's probably right. I think that in the whole book of Deuteronomy, for example, can be seen as really an expansion of the Ten Commandments. You can actually go through and you can see how you move from one commandment to another in the concerns of the book of Deuteronomy. I think that's probably the best way to view them. To relate that more specifically to a couple of the comments on judgment, it's interesting that in the Ten Commandments you don't have a penalty specified. And as is the case with many other laws, a few you do. I don't know, do you want to push that further, Buzz, somehow?
It just seems to me that this idea that we do that we can break the law and get away with it is another way of saying what I thought I heard you say. That is that we never break the laws, but we get broken when we fail to keep them.
Okay. Okay, another way, which let me see if I'm getting where you're going here. Breaking of a relationship is just much more important and crucial than the breaking of a law. And if we think of the law in relational terms, namely that what's happening in that, and the law is given as a gift. We sometimes think of that big, you know, the law hanging over our lives or whatever. The law is a gift. Then it may go well with you. You know, if you obey the law, things are going to go better. And the relationships are going to be better. That's not, you know, the law is not given to sort of be a threat hanging over your lives, you know, sort of looking at you, watching you carefully. But it's in your own best interests. That's why the law is given. Guidelines for life, you know. You enter into a marriage relationship, and you do read Dear Abby now and again, and kind of get some helps as to how this might work best. You know, you need a little instruction with regard to these relationships. You don't have it all together with regard to what's in the best interests of the relationship and what's not. So you like instruction. You like some suggestions. You like some directions. Huh? Also with the relationship with God. The law gives you a sketch, some directions, some indications of how things might go better, go best. And so if you talk about disobeying, then that in relational terms, then that what you're talking there is you're talking about the fact that the relationship is being affected adversely, and not just some external, you know, law out there, impersonal, on the books, is getting broken.
Gary?
Yeah?
Houston Smith described that as those wise restraints that make man free. Minimal rules that liberate us.
Yeah, you know, that's good. You realize that 8 of the 10 commandments are stated negatively and 2 are positive. And the negative commandments are really remarkable because all they do is they leave all sorts of aspects of one's life free. They just say, don't do that. If you have a positive commandment, that's much more restrictive. Right? You've got to do that. Honor your father and your mother and keep the Sabbath day. Those are the 2 positive ones. And so that's more restrictive than the negative commandment. But it's true. I think maximum freedom, I think, is made possible by certain restrictions. Yes, ma'am.
The Lutheran woman today is full of feed the.
Be careful! My wife's involved in the publication of that one. You have to.
Not correctly.
I'm sorry.
It's full of feed the hungry, visit the sick, visit the people in prison. We're being imbued with this. I'm coming to understand that is what God expects of me. I believe I'm almost making it law. And I wonder what you could say about this in relation to our relational, put that next to the relational aspect.
As a relationship, let's take a marriage relationship for a moment. And those who aren't married to them, apologize for the analogy. In a relationship, a marriage relationship, as the relationship matures and as it grows, certain things you begin to do because you want to do them. I mean, there's no stricken conscience there. Oh, I better do this one right now. Or there's no law sitting on the kitchen or the refrigerator door saying, "Now." There is on occasion, I know. But then, but you know, you do certain things naturally because of the relationship. It just flows as the relationship matures, certain behaviors flow. And that's the way one ought to think. I think about some of the matters that you raised, okay, we have this relationship with God, we have this relationship with others, that there's certain things that we ought to do as a matter of, we want to do them because of the relationship. And they don't hang over us then, like, uh-oh, we got a checklist here, or specific, well, you're sort of carrying around in your pocket, you've got these 655 things you got to be attentive to as Christians, you know, unless even, you know, that kind of thing, that gets to be pretty demonic, almost, to a relationship if you got all the checklist over against which to measure your behavior, to prompt your behavior. Let's hope that Christians, in the maturation of their relationship, will assume those kinds of responsibilities gladly and naturally. But we continue to sin, we continue to need to be prompted, and we continue to fail, so we'll need now and again to be reminded, and it'll come at us then as a kind of twitching of the conscience. It may come at us, depending upon our own situation, it may come at us pretty hard that we've really been neglectful. So it's kind of like, it's sort of like, you know, again, in a marriage, you know, if you've been neglecting certain things, then certain things come at you almost as law. Yeah.
Isn't this fourth commandment a two-way street? In order for a healthy relationship to exist, the parents have to honor their children too.
Yeah, I think, you know, if one were to sort of expand upon that commandment and sort of think through its implications, I think you'd finally get there. That's not in the front of, sort of in the front seat on that commandment. The front seat of that commandment is the relationship of children to parents. But it's not simply, I really misspoke there, it's not simply children to parents, it's adults to, it's adults to their parents too. I think we oftentimes take the fourth commandment and think solely in terms of children. And I mean, I've got a father and a mother, and if that commandment applies to me at 52 years old just as much as it applies to my children, to me. Why is it that we take the fourth commandment and apply it to only kids? So I mean, that's the front seat on that commandment. But you know, if you were to spell it out and talk in terms of relationships, yes, then you'd get to your point to me. Sure thing. Evelyn.
I was wondering about prophets today who I think may be seeking to do God's will in speaking to the nation and showing anger at the nation's policy. Certainly the prophets of the Old Testament were speaking, as you said, primarily anger of God on their own people, and yet anyone who tries to do that today is really considered very unpatriotic and so on, and it's pretty difficult for people to speak for God inside the culture. It's easy to zap somebody else, but in your own culture to show anger, righteous anger, against what's going on.
Well, Jesus' statement here applies not simply to the Old Testament prophets and to himself, but also to contemporary prophets. A prophet is without honor in his own country. And it'll always be so, I think. The prophets were, we've got these amazing pages in the Old Testament. But boy, let me tell you, if it had been up to the local congregations to vote on whether or not these books were to be placed in the Bible, or whether or not they would approve those sermons, I mean, the prophets would have been read out of those congregations in a hurry. No, there's not a church council in Jerusalem that would have voted in favor of any of these boys. Mix the contemporary and the ancient for a moment. And so, I think that contemporary prophets, those who bring the word of judgment in the right way, have to probably inevitably live with the fact that it's going to be tough. It's just going to be tough. And they're not going to be listened to. They're going to be called extremists. are going to be tough, they're going to be, because it's, the word of the prophet is so upsetting of the status quo, the way things are. So I don't know if you've got any way around that, Evelyn, but it's certainly, it's a correct observation. I think it's probably inevitable given human nature, given the nature of cultures, given the fact that traditions hang on so strongly among us. It's hard to break through. Yeah, Jim.
In the slow to anger of God, I see there is a long period of suffering of God before he really expresses his anger. So that slow anger could be translated almost as long suffering. Huh? And secondly, I think that if you sin against God, you sin against yourself. In other words, thou shalt not kill is not so very nice for the man you have killed, but it's also not good for you.
I think the, agree, the slow to anger, remember those passages that we, they really connects well with yesterday's discussion. Yeah. And I think we had the passages in Hosea in particular, you know, what shall I do with you? Chapter 6:4 of Hosea, what shall I do with you? And sort of God, you know, that long-suffering parent, those parental images again and again, you know, trying every conceivable means, you know, how can we get things back in order here? And so God suffers the pains of parenthood on and on and on before the dam breaks loose and you've got to hit bottom, as it were, before there's a way back up. And so that's true. Long suffering is that old King James yeah. word that I think is still useful in this connection. Yeah, Phil.
We mentioned Exodus the other day. You know, when Moses was more or less arguing with God, didn't he sort of lose his patience at that time? Or aren't we aware of that?
You know, Moses lost patience with God, or with the people, or certain.
No, I mean, didn't God lose a little patience with Moses?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think that there are moments in God's relationship to Moses where there is some impatience. This also happens the other way around, where Moses expresses some impatience with God. That proves to be some interesting conversation, particularly in the book of Numbers. And one can talk about the end of the, you know, slow to anger, the long-suffering God, and finally there is an end to patience. I mean, it just, you know, let it go. It's just got to hit bottom. It's got to come. Judgment's got to come. And one can talk about an end of patience at that point. And along the way, clearly, say the you get the long string of stories about the people murmuring in the wilderness. If you set all those stories, starting at the Exodus 16 and going all the way to Numbers 21, you set up, what is it, about 10 different stories of murmurings. And it's kind of interesting to watch God's, not only the human progress across those 10 stories, but God's progress across those 10 stories. And you find an increasing impatience on God's part with respect to these people who are forever complaining because they've been saved. Yes.
Using the term contemporary prophets loosely, I think we hear a great deal about how healthy it is to show our anger, blow our stack, which I think flies right into the face of the nature of God, being slow to anger and angry only for a moment. And then we get to the New Testament where we see a relationship with our fellow man. We're told, be not angry with your brother, for anger does not fulfill the righteous purpose of God. Any comment on that?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I was stopped between the sessions this morning had a little conversation about anger as catharsis, and that people have less cholesterol if they get angry now and again. A few things like that there are sort of biological effects of the expression of anger. If you bottle yourself all up inside and never get it out, it has ill effects on you. I think you're right that one can sort of rest a little too easily with that and think that, hey, I can get angry at anything under the sun and that's good for me, sort of thing.
Slow, not lasting long.
Right. I think that slow to anger is still a good word. And we're asked to walk in all of God's ways, and that's probably a good word. I mean, one has to examine each and every context as to what might be appropriate there, but and certainly for a moment, not to let it live forever. That may be our worst sin, letting our anger live forever.
Well, there's a difference, too, in anger at situations and anger at people. You can be very, very angry at situations and yet still love the people who are maybe trapped in this. And I think, well, you know, you do not necessarily break the relationship with the people who are involved in the situation. I think there is a difference.
Sure, there are. I understood him commenting about people. And if you expand that to situations, then it becomes a little different kind of situation, I think, where you can have where one's anger may need to be rather more extensive and expansive.
I think that to deal with something like that, one should recognize that anyone's knowledge is limited, and therefore a situation which may cause us to anger requires some reflection and thought. And we may discover after a little thinking about it that there are things involved that I first did not understand.
I think that's so, and that suggests some slowness to anger as well there. We need careful reflection and study of a given situation needs to enter into it. in every case, no question.
Isn't there anger, which is a part of the grief process, when someone loses a loved one?
Yeah, I think Kubler Ross's five stages of dying would be one. Anger is an integral part of those processes. In any Old Testament, you know, half of the Book of Psalms consists of laments. And in some of those laments, you get which are laments for because of illness, because of injustice, because of death on one's door. Anger is a part of some of those psalms, and so it's. I think that's in. Probably an appropriate use of anger. We come back to what we said at the beginning, that there are Jesus uses anger appropriately, and I think there are ways in which in that process anger can be used in helpful and appropriate ways. I think one of the keys there is to be self-conscious with regard to sort of self-aware of oneself as much as one can possibly be in those situations, so that it doesn't go on forever. That could be a problem. Yes?
Isn't one of the demonic aspects of our expressions of anger that we tend to displace it on innocent scapegoats or other children or other people, weaker persons? We don't take it out against a strong person. We displace it.
Kick the dog. Yeah. And take it out on our kids.
You always take it out on those others.
Yeah. What it's kind of interesting, one of some of the things that you're pointing up here are, to come back to the metaphor talk, what you're doing is that you're pointing out continuities and discontinuities between human anger and the anger of God. And that's a beautiful example of how our anger is different from the anger of God. God's anger is not displaced. God will not kick the dog. God will not take it out on the kids. I mean, to, you know, extend the metaphor. There's discontinuity there. That's very helpful as you try to think through appropriate ways of talking about anger and God together. Yes?
Also, I think for humans, if we can be angry quickly and get it over with, that oftentimes it amounts to very little or nothing, whereas the long-standing or long-suffering anger that we may carry can have very major consequences.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so there are, we're going to need to come back and put Evelyn's comment alongside that one as well, that there may be instances of where anger does need to be more extensive and expansive because of the nature of a very complex situation. Well, it's 10 o'clock, and tomorrow we talk about the sexuality of God. Thank you for today.